Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends.
Some of our stuff is big, you know, and I'm just like, it sells so well. Yeah. Like, I see how many fucking huge dildos I sell. The size of my forearm, you know, with my fist
it's
on
like
the end of
it.
2 foot
dildos.
Yeah, you know? Whenever someone asks me for like a gift box or like whatever, like I always include like a gigantic dildo. So now they have to hold on to this gigantic dildo in their house or in their closet.
Let's get a fucking gigantic dildo.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today, I'm making friends with Chad Braverman. And look, guys, this is going to be an interesting conversation because Chad is the CEO of the largest manufacturer of sex toys in the United States. So they actually have a facility in Los Angeles. They've been around since the 1970s. Chad actually got the business from his dad, who founded it in the 1970s. So in this conversation, we talk all things sex toys. We talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in a household, especially back in the 70s and 80s, where your parents are in the sex toy business, and what it was like kind of navigating that, how his dad told him about those things, what the process was by which Chad learned every piece of the business before he ended up taking it over as the CEO from his dad, the things that he's done since then. We honestly talk a lot more about the business side of things than we do about what most people would probably ask about. Actually, when we got done with the conversation, Chad was like, oh, that was actually probably useful for people instead of people asking me about all the different sex toys that I see. But don't worry, I did ask some interesting questions towards the end of the conversation. So you're going to want to stick around for those. This is just a fun conversation because I find it fascinating how many different ways people make money in this country, especially when we're talking about multi nine figures in annual revenue. And then it being in just such a weird niche like this, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, the stuff gets made, but you're not exactly sure when or how or by whom or how it all works and all that. Well, we talk about how some of that stuff works. We also talk about some of the best sellers that they've had, some things that may be surprising to you, but also some things that are probably like, oh yeah, that makes sense. This is just a fun conversation. Chad was a really, really easy guy to talk to. And we talked, don't worry, a lot of practical things in this episode as well, even on navigating the relationship with his parents and then now with his kids, all about how they were in this business in particular. So without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Chad Braverman. Chad, what's up, dude? Welcome to the show.
Dude, thank you for having me. Pleasure to meet you.
Yes, sir. We're in your neck of the woods, right?
Yeah, I'm not too far from here. Okay. I'm over in North Hollywood.
Massive warehouse, I assume. How big is your warehouse?
So we have 250,000 square feet of what used to be, we would call it like manufacturing facility. Our entire operation is based there. You know, we started in 1976, and pretty much since day one, we've been the largest U.S. manufacturer of sex toys.
And this was your dad's company.
It was, yeah. He founded it in 76. I only bring it up to say that during COVID, we were starting to make an expansion.
Okay.
And we couldn't do that anymore where we were because we were like maxed out. So we got some facility down in Mexicali.
Okay.
And we made an expansion down there, and then COVID hit, and that started to become like a transition.
Hmm.
So actually now, almost all of our manufacturing is down in Mexico.
Okay.
But our facility, we still have all of our operations run out of there.
Okay.
Our lab is still there because we make all of our own lubricants and all of our own like lotions and potions.
Damn.
And we also mold a lot of performers. Okay. And so we have that on site. Our entire mold department is on site. So we're still a really big facility. We just don't have that manufacturing component right now.
Okay. So unpack what it's like, you know, to to grow up in the house of a sex toy manufacturer. Like, you know, most kids are like, oh yeah, my dad's a, you know, a policeman. My dad's a
doctor, lawyer,
real estate agent or whatever, you know? And it's like, oh,
you named almost everything that all of my best friends' dads do. So take anything that you think it's like, and then just do the complete opposite. And that's what it was like, because the truth is, you know, I'm 41, I'm going to be 42 in May, right? So I don't know how old you are, but so I'm a little bit past your generation of, I did not grow up with the internet at all. You know, that did not come until I already kind of knew what my dad did.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, I was kind of that generation that could be easily lied to by their parents, which I was, because of course, like, mainly it was still really taboo. So it wasn't as accepted as it is today.
Of course,
people don't, you know, necessarily think it's as cool or whatever. But, you know, my dad told me and everybody else in my life that he was in the medical supply business.
Okay.
You know, and it's just,
I
like,
mean, technically.
Yeah. Well, they were marital aids in the beginning. Super boring.
Yeah.
You know, it can be lucrative, you know, and, you know, he was successful. So it kind of like, no one really asked follow-up questions to the medical supply business.
Yeah.
So for me, I was really completely in the dark almost most of my childhood. I found out sort of definitively at 13.
Well, there's just right like around surprise. There.
Well, you know, look, you know, I realize now because I have two kids, like they hear everything.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like my kid, my oldest is 5 and a half and he's fucking, I'm sorry, can you swear?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, he's smarter than I was at like 12.
Yeah. They're sponges,
and,
man.
Yeah.
My son's 4 and a half.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you got it. And like, I picked up on things.
Yeah.
Okay. Things that I knew the words, but I didn't know what they meant.
Yeah,
you know, even just like, I remember one time at dinner, someone was at dinner that worked for my dad at the time, and he brought up an order for a retail store there used to be in the Valley called Le Sex Shop. Right. And it's like, I know the word sex. So
he brought
it up and I kind of caught my dad. Like, he's like, you know, and I kind of caught that. And then the biggie is he brought me to his office, probably at a point where I was old enough to know like that I had a penis.
Yeah.
Right. And that like my dad had a lot of them. You know, like I knew what a penis like looked like. And I'm why does my dad have like penises everywhere? You know, and all this other sort of stuff. But I was like, I don't know if it was my embarrassment or what, but I didn't say to him. Like, like my son today, like I feel like if I took, he'd be like, why are there penises here?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, like he would want to know immediately and like he wouldn't stop asking me.
Yeah.
And I don't remember ever like talking to him about it.
Yeah.
You know, and so piecing together rubber penises, Le Sex Shop.
Yeah.
You know, then
I mean,
I don't know, whatever else it was along the way.
Yeah.
Then there was like the definitive.
I mean, based on those clues though, like the result was probably the best case scenario. Like if it weren't that you were in this business, then we might have some difficult conversations.
There was definitely a moment, you know, where I was pretty convinced that he was like in the mob or something, something illegal, illicit. Because look, man, you know, thank God, like he's successful.
Yeah.
So I knew that I grew up very privileged, like didn't really want for anything in my life. I went to a really good, like private school here in Los Angeles. You know, and like I said to you in the beginning, like my friend, I had like six best friends in the whole world that I grew up with since like kindergarten, first grade, like doctor, dentist, real estate agent, lawyer, and I'm missing one, but like, so I knew those professions.
Yeah, especially.
And then my dad was like, import, export, you know, and you're like, wait a second, what the fuck is import, export, you know?
Import, export. What?
Yeah, and that's kind of when like the medical supply thing came and,
You
know, private label, you know, hair dryers and
What was your reaction when you like, was he just like, all right, look, this is just how it is?
No, it wasn't him. I had a stepbrother. I had an older stepbrother and he had recently moved. Most of my childhood, he lived in Beverly Hills And like my parents are divorced, so I didn't grow up living with my dad. Okay. Got so, okay. you know, we were more on the weekend schedule type, you know, thing that divorced kids did back then. Mm-hmm. And he lived my whole childhood in Beverly Hills. But around the time that I was like 12 or 13, he moved to another house in Beverly Hills that was like much bigger, much more grand in scale.
Yeah.
And one of my best friends came over, and I think it was the first time he was at the house. And, you know, we were in one of the rooms or something, and he was like, I mean, this is how much you can tell no one had any clue what my dad did, is like my best friend since kindergarten is literally at my house. And he goes, like, looking around, he's like, what? What's your dad do again? And I was like, oh, he makes medical supplies. And my stepbrother, who was like 17, was in the same room. And he goes, that's not what your dad does. And I like kind of look at him, and he goes, your dad makes fake dicks and pussies. And I mean, like, that is a quote, because I remember it like yesterday. And honestly, my thing was really like relief. Like, I was like, I knew it. Like, I knew
something was awry here.
Yeah,
and I'm glad to know that it's that.
At 12 or 13 now, you're starting to know, obviously, like, what sex is and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I still wasn't aware that, like, people used sex toys.
Sure.
But I got the concept. And obviously, having an older stepbrother sped that up a little bit for me.
Right.
But yeah, for me, it was like more of relief in the sense of like, fuck, I knew it. I'm kind of glad I know it for real now.
Yeah.
The only thing I probably would have changed, even though it meant nothing in the long run, is like, I probably wouldn't have done it in front of like my best friend, who obviously went to school the next day and was like, Chad's dad makes big dicks, you know, like all that.
Yeah.
But the truth is, like, I'm very lucky and like fortunate. Like, I went, like I said, I went to a small school. I kind of had already solidified like my place in that school, my friend, my group of friends and stuff. So really, I have an easy story in the sense of like, I never felt ostracized.
Yeah.
I was never like made fun of for it.
Sure.
And it literally changed nothing in my life.
It's also like hard to make fun of you at that point, because it's like, yeah, but look at,
we were
like,
at
look
an,
at the business, like what the business has done.
We were at an age where what he did was just goofy and silly.
Sure.
Right, penis is still a funny word.
It's just funny.
To a 13-year-old, to a 12-year-old, right? You're still doing the penis game in class, you know, stuff like that. So it wasn't like...
Wait. What's the penis game?
Oh, like,
really, like saying the word penis. Yeah.
Well, like,
who
you say
can
it really...
say it loudest?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you're 12, 13-year-old.
I always lost that game.
And I mean, I also feel like we were, again, the generation that had no phones, no internet in that part of our childhood, like, these dumb games meant a lot more to us.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, that's I don't know if the kids are still playing penis or, you know, whatever, but like, we were,
that's probably, you know, that's a fair
at
point.
12 or 13. Yeah. Like, it was a big part.
There's not as much of that stuff going on.
You know, you're in a mall and your buddy looks at you and goes, penis, you know, and you just know it's on from there. Yeah. Right. Like, how crazy can we get here? So yeah. And then, you know, fast forward, I go to college and right away I'm just telling people like, oh yeah, my family makes sex toys. And they're like, what?
Yeah.
Can you send send a huge box? Like, then it becomes the coolest profession that someone can say their parent has.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, again, it's not like he's like doing this as a side hustle in the basement.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean? Like, it's pouring dildos after hours. But
it's an operation. Like, it's a real
business. I went from, or I guess I should say, like, my family went from like telling not telling people what we did because we didn't want to have the conversation, to me not telling people what I do because I actually don't want to have the conversation.
Yeah, sure.
Because now it's like, oh my God, like, I got to introduce
it's
you
gone
to
from
so-and-so.
Like, taboo to like, this is super interesting.
Or like, I'm like the fucking guy at the dinner party that like, everyone's like, what do you do? And I like tell them and they're like, I already knew that. Like, Travis told me, but I just wanted to talk to you about like this, and this. And I'm just like, you know, and I'm cool about it, of course, but like, there are some times where like, I'll be on a plane and someone like flying around for business or whatever. And they'll be like, you know, you're sitting next to those people, like the person next to you, like, oh, what are you in Hong Kong for?
The talkative people.
Yeah. And I'm like, plastics. Like, I'm just like, I don't want to like get into this you right now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, childhood was like legit. No like weirdness. I'm now trying to figure out what I'm going to do. Like with my kids.
Sure.
Because I don't have the same Like my kid just started kindergarten and every person in my school knows what I do.
Mm. Yeah. There's there's no anonymity.
No, there's not. I mean, and I probably could have thought about that earlier on in my life, but I mean, like if you Google me,
right,
like you're going to get, I didn't come up with like an alien. People have done that in my business and I think it's smart. And I look back at it and I say like, maybe I should have done it just for the option.
Hmm.
You know, but I'm way past that point because everything we do now lives on in infamy and foreverness.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, if you Google Chad Braverman, there's not actually a lot of Chad Bravermans out there. Oddly enough, too, you know, like I'm not Michael Smith.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so it's a pretty unique name and I'm the one that comes up.
Right.
10 out of 10 times. So you're going to see me and you're going to see articles about me and the business and this podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and I'm out there, I'm forward facing because, you know, I want people to know about the brand.
Right.
And I want to promote the brand. I want to market the brand. So, you know, my kid's 5 and a half.
Part of the game.
I'm trying to figure out, you know, I don't have a lot of years left. You know?
Sure. Yeah.
Before he wants to come to work with me. Like he wants to know what I do. And like he talks about my company.
Yeah.
Like he knows my company's name is Doc Johnson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He knows.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, that's gotta be difficult to navigate.
So we'll see. I've lived through one generation of it as the kid.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting and fortunate that I'm here to kind of live through the second.
Is your dad still working in the business?
My dad's around.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
He just kind of
like he loves to come in,
pops out.
He loves to come in for a couple hours, you know, pretty much every day.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's his baby, right?
Like, yeah. And you know, look, it's his baby and he is a hard worker. Like his whole life, like that's he's a worker bee, you know, like that is his personality. And so he'll come in until the day he can't.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
right.
In terms of the day-to-day operations, the day-to-day like running of the business, he doesn't do that anymore.
Sure.
But he likes to be present. He likes to be there. He'll cherry-check certain meetings that are important to him.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, was it his intention to build a sex toy company or was it like, hey, we're starting into this thing and then all of a sudden somebody placed an order and it's like, oh, well, let's fulfill that and now there's more demand and we got to keep up with it or like, how did that kind of happen?
Yeah. So yes and no. His intention was very much to start a sex toy business, but that was after about 10 years in the adult industry, which happened extremely by chance.
Okay.
And that's a really right place, right time story.
Sure,
and he, you know, got connected with a guy who kind of like the godfather of like the whole adult business back in the day.
Okay.
And went to work for him, started just in the magazine business, like running magazines up and down the East Coast.
Okay.
Kind of worked his way up the organization. That guy had many, many levels to his organization at the time.
Sure.
And eventually gets put overseas in the UK and in Amsterdam operating stores.
Okay.
And the main difference that he saw in Europe versus the US was US was totally reliant on videos and the jerk-off booths, for lack of a better term, in the back of the store.
Okay.
That's where everybody made their money. And sex toys were like shrink wrapped in like bins and you'd literally have to like search through it, like fucking play it against sports, you know, like, and you go in looking for like an old mitt. And I don't know why that came to mind, but it did. And in Europe, sex toys were like proudly displayed and like, you know, they were like on cards and they were like packaged and people were coming in, couples and women and stuff like that, that you never saw in American stores. And they were buying sex toys.
Hmm.
And for him, that was kind of like the aha moment. And that's really where he set his intentions in to do. And there was a very small manufacturer in North Hollywood, exactly where we are today, by the name of Marche Manufacturing. And that was actually, oddly enough, also a family. It was the dad and the mom, and I think a daughter and a son. And he made mostly, regular things, mainly fishing lures and things like that.
Okay.
But he had the machinery, he had the material, and they were also making some adult toys, some dildos and some, strap-ons.
Okay.
And the reason he was doing the strap-ons is because technically back then that was like a medical device because it was like an ED device.
Ah.
So for men that had erectile dysfunction, and it was just these super, I don't want to use the word like grotesque, but like rudimentary, like dildo shape, and they were hollow. So the man could put, you know, his flaccid or not erect penis inside of it.
Gotcha.
And use it as a strap-on.
Yeah.
And Ron purchased that company and turned it into Doc Johnson with the intention right away to get rid of all of the ancillary stuff, which was actually the majority of Marche business
at the time.
And was, I'm 100% going to become, you know, a sex toy company.
Yeah.
And added, you know, hundreds of SKUs within the first couple of years to that line.
Wow.
And
already had some relationships, obviously, with some distributors and.
Yeah, tons of relationships. And I mean, it was successful from the first hour, you know, like majorly, majorly successful.
So was it your intention to always be a part of the business? Like after you figured out everything was going on, you're 12, 13, you're going through high school, you're trying to figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life. Was it kind of like, this is the path that I'm going to go down, or was it?
So yes and no. Like I'm an only child.
Okay.
So first generation company, successful company.
Yeah.
Even if you put the sex part of it out, there's a certain amount of pressure that I think is on you.
Sure.
To be like,
whatever the business is,
where is this company going to go
if
it doesn't go to me? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, I know he would have sold it or something, you know, and then that's kind of just it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a pressure to just be like, okay, I think I have to kind of carry the baton to the next stage.
Sure.
Then you add in the fact that, like, it was a successful business and it isn't a really cool industry and a really fun industry. And it's not like a wire hanger manufacturer.
Sure. Yeah.
It was definitely something that I always felt was like going to be a part of my life. I made a promise to myself that when I went to college, because I worked at Doc Johnson every summer from eighth grade going into my like freshman year of high school.
Yeah.
Right. So I worked at Doc Johnson every summer from freshman year of high school all the way through college.
Awesome.
And I decided that when I went to college, like I was going to do that regardless. I mean, in the beginning, it was a mandate, right? And then it became something that I felt like was really helpful for me as a person and for me if I went to Doc Johnson long term.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But I said when I went to college.
To know like each piece of the business from the ground up.
I mean, especially a company like ours who is a real manufacturer. Like we have manufacturing, packaging, finishing, shipping, receiving. We have a lab. We have chemists. Mm-hmm. We have, you know,
it's
everything.
A lot of shit.
So it's a lot of stuff to kind of like understand and learn. And at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to, I think to run our company successfully, you have to have an operations mindset. You have to have a creative mindset, of course, because we develop new product and you got to package it and you got to work with an art department and all that sort of stuff. But you can really pawn the creative off if you want to, but you've got to understand the operations of the company.
Yeah.
So I made a promise to myself when I went to college, like be open-eyed. Like if you find something that is your passion or that you really want to go and do, because I knew going to work for like the family business was going to be really hard.
Sure.
Like regardless of what it is, it's just hard. It's really hard to work with your parents or anyone in your family, really.
It's a weird dynamic, for sure.
It's a weird dynamic, and it's one that it took me a while to kind of get used to.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to be like annoyed or frustrated with like your work environment or your boss, and then your boss is like, oh, see you for dinner at the house tonight.
Right.
And you're like, no, man, I don't want to.
Actually, fuck off.
I don't want to have fucking dinner tonight with you and like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
I can't separate.
Most people don't have to do that. And you got to separate that. And Ron, my dad, was always really good at that. He was like, you know, from 8 to 5, you're my employee. And from 5 to 8, you're my son. You know, and like, it's like, we've got to have that dynamic for it to work. And it took me a while to kind of like get that. And I think it definitely put a strain on our relationship for a long time in the sense of just like, you know, it's like taking work home with you.
Right.
Literally.
Right.
You know?
Well, especially at a time in your life where you're supposed to be kind of like separating from your dad, you know, like at any, you're 20 to 25, 20 to 30 even sometimes is like the time in your life as a young man where you're becoming a man. And
yeah, it's like a natural
requires this like separation from your dad in that sense. And so if you're
internally too,
yeah,
you know, like it's right. a natural part of like growing up to be mm-hmm. like, I'm not reliant on you
right.
anymore.
Right.
And when you go to work healthy. For your parent, you are, I mean, you're relying on them.
Totally.
Like you can be an amazing employee and mm-hmm. you can come into that organization and just be super successful. And there's still this part of it where it's like, well, who's responsible for my success?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and then the part that I always try to tell people, like, you know, if anyone talks to me about family business or, you know, the ins and the outs of it is, you gotta look at every other person at that company that's not your parent, because that is really where some of the difficulty comes in, you know, with, when you're starting, especially being a peer.
Sure.
And you're not, because yeah, you're the owner's son.
Because I'd assume like executive team has been there for 10, 15, 20 years by the time you're stepping into a yeah. role where they now have to kind of defer to you as yeah. the like authority, which has got to be a weird dynamic for them to like yeah. have been there building
the witness protection program, I call them.
Witness protection program?
Yeah.
Why is that?
You know, just a lot of people that are comfy in their position.
Yeah.
Protected.
Yeah.
You know, you come in, you're kind of like the young gun.
Sure.
You know,
want to shake
things
up.
You think you're the shit because you've read all the textbooks from like the business management like major that you just like yeah. graduated with. And you're like, you know, you try to come in and you're just like, oh, I'm going to take over this fucking place. And I'm going to like, I know how to like make us more efficient and make us more like profitable. And,
right.
you know, then you come into this, yeah, this group that's been there for a really, really long time. And,
right.
you know, you kind of realize like, I don't know, always refer to them as the witness protection program.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Well, it's a really hard environment to come into. And you always have this kind of, you know, assumption of nepotism rather than competence.
Oh, it's not an assumption. I mean, it's levied on you, you know, I mean, from right. day one.
Right.
I mean, even today now it's the new term is nepo baby.
Right.
You right. know, and I mean, it's there. And yeah. and look, it's omnipresent because it's in your head and it's in everyone else's head too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where it's really difficult is with your peers that you outgrow at a faster pace because you are on a different trajectory. You
yeah.
are moving up through the organization. And it's true. Your successes are going to be different than theirs and your failures are going to be different than theirs.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and, but the only way through is just, you know, just fucking work hard and just do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Cause you can't control that. You know, I'm confident in myself and like, I'm confident in like my, you know, what I'm able to do. And, mm-hmm. And then at that point you just got to do it and then just say like, yeah, I mean, my trajectory is different. I'm not a schmuck.
Mm-hmm.
So like,
yeah,
I'm
right,
not
right.
going to stay at some
yeah.
level here at this
sure,
company
sure.
because my dad knows I can't like, make it to the next level.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
And
I'm not Billy Madison. Over
yeah.
there.
So I am going to climb up and end up in that witness protection program room with
yeah.
maybe people who right. don't feel like, you know, I should be there or
yeah.
don't feel like I should be there as quickly or like whatever it is. So, but I'm 41 now. I mean, the weirdness of that or whatever, you know, passed me by a long time ago.
Sure, sure. Yeah. You've had time to prove yourself a little bit.
Yeah. My 20s there were hard.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Like my 20s were hard. I graduated and I went right to work.
Yeah. It's one of those like you got to work harder. You got to outwork everybody, but you still don't get any of the credit for it.
Yeah.
You know? It's like you work really, like, really
hard. You could work till way past everybody goes home at 5. You're,
right.
you don't leave until whatever time. And then one day you leave at 4:45 and it's like, oh, wait, he can?
Right. Right.
He can leave whenever he wants.
There goes Nepo.
Yeah, there goes Nepo Chad. So, but I mean, yeah, I mean, that comes with the territory. But you got to be, you know, you do have to be strong-willed.
Sure.
Because it's hard. I mean, and like I said, it can break you down with all these different relationships.
It comes with its own unique set of challenges. You know, there was this post of Bronny James the other day on SportsCenter on Instagram, and it was like, he's playing for USC, and he was like running into the tunnel from the court, mm-hmm. and he like jumped to just like slap the
and he hit his head.
Yeah, and he jumped too high and like smacked his head on it.
Yeah.
And it was like one of those things where like he just thought nobody was watching. He's just like a kid, just, you know,
except
jumping.
All the cameras are on.
Yeah, except for that, like everybody was still watching him because he's Bronny fucking James. And I like had commented on it. I said something like, this poor kid's like never going to have a moment of privacy, you know? And then it was just wild to see how many people replied back to that comment and were just saying stuff like, oh yeah, this poor kid.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
it's so terrible for him.
And that's it's like, exactly what I was going to say is like, you can talk to people about the sort of the hardships of being in a family business or being a part of, you know, a nepotism, you know, dynamic.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10. Every single one of those people are going to look at you and be like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the violin fucking thing.
Champagne and I
get
problems.
It. Like, I totally get it.
Right.
Like, I absolutely do. I mean, you know, my dad's not LeBron James, but like,
right.
as terms of like the adult business goes, like, he's close.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean?
In
like,
that world, he's on the Mount Rushmore.
He's an OG, triple OG, you know, fucking head of this business. And people know Ron. You know, not everybody likes him, but everybody knows him and respects him and like knows at the end of the day that like, you know, you got to understand something about my dad too, is that like back in the day, you know, the government wanted to shut this industry down.
Really?
You know, so,
that's wild.
My dad and a bunch of other people in the adult business that were powerful at the time, like they got together to like fight the government to like stay in business. Hmm. And one of the ways that they did that was by setting up an organization called the FSC, which is the Free Speech Coalition. Hmm. And the main intention of that was to help the little mom and pop shops that the government was coming after.
Yeah.
Because
those are the
government
ones
realized
the
that if you could pick off the weakest part of the business, in turn, my dad would have nowhere for his product to be sold.
Hmm.
Right?
Sure.
So they went after all these like sole operators, mom and pops, you know, the real sort of like middle class kind of part of the country. And what my dad and some other owners did was they banded together and they pooled money for these retailers to fight their legal cases. And, you know, the truth is, thank God, like we won a lot of them. And a lot of these commissions that they set up and a lot of these organizations and these sort of task force that they set up, were very unsuccessful. But a lot of it is because people like my dad and his, you know, peers at the time existed. So even if you just put aside like Ron's like business acumen, right? There's things that he and people at his generation did for this business that this business is even like here today.
Sure.
And thriving the way that it's thriving. So, you know, there's big shoes there.
Yeah,
and there's people that know me from yay high, you know, that are like, oh, look at big Chad now, you know, or like whatever. And maybe there's like a difference or, you know, I'd go to these trade shows sometimes and people would know me because I was Chad Braverman, Ron's son.
Sure.
And I had met them before, but I didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would only be working there in the summer. And so I'd be like, oh, hi, I'm Chad Braverman. They'd be like, yeah, we met. You know, and then you feel like, oh man, okay, I'm the asshole. You know, different now that I'm there full time, but like it's definitely one of those things where, you know, but again, it's the violin because you know, a lot of things in my life are because of my company and I didn't start it.
Yeah, right. How do you view that from now, like being a parent with your own kids? Like how do you?
Oh, I mean,
navigate that.
I think I could. So on one hand, I don't care at all because you're a dad. You just want to give your kids everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like I don't want them to be spoiled brats. I want them to work for it. And that's part of like, I know what my dad wanted. Like my dad did not grow up the same way that I grew up. He grew up, you know, super, you know, he grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. You know, the 1950s, you know, American working class. Like that's what he grew up as.
Yep.
You know, so in a lot of ways, he's you know, he's first generation wealth.
Wealth, yeah.
And, you know, my kids, I hope, will be second generation, you know? So it's different. He was like, you're going to work. Like that eighth grade going into freshman year, none of my friends were working.
Right.
None of them.
Right.
And he was like, you're going to work. You don't have to work 5 days a week for your entire summer.
Sure. Sure.
Like you can go, you know, on vacation,
yeah.
And go to a camp or like whatever it was at the time. But he was
you
like,
do have
you
a job.
Are working.
Yeah, and you do have responsibilities. Yeah.
100%. So I'm all about that. And I'm all about that life for them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I can tell them if they decide if Doc Johnson is still in its current form and, you know, they want to come into the business, I'll be able to sit them down and talk to them about what that means.
Yeah.
That Ron would have never been able to have sat down and talked to me about.
Hmm. Sure.
You know,
so. Well, because he never experienced that part.
No.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, I talked about like eyes wide open before and there's like, it's like, I've lived it, you know? So I'm going to tell you right now what this is going to take and, you know, how you'll be successful if you want to come and do this. But I mean, I would love, obviously, I mean, now that I'm a dad, it's like, shit, I would love to have my kids come to work with me. I mean, I know my dad's loved it.
Right, right.
You know, even the times that were stressful or hard or, you know, strained us, you know, relationship wise, but like, oh, I'd take that 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah, right, right.
For sure.
When you first came in as like, was there a day where they're like, okay, now Chad's in charge? Or was it just like
April
a gradual,
1st,
slow,
19, you know? No, it was definitely gradual and slow, you know, being fully transparent. Like I said, there were a few people in that witness protection program. Kind of got its name because I felt there were a few people that shouldn't be where they were.
Yeah.
And some of those people, it turned out that I was right.
Hmm.
And so, you know, it definitely took me, like I said, my 20s there were pretty hard, you know? So that first sort of like 10 years of my career there was a little bit difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about leaving?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, a lot. A lot, a lot.
What kept you there?
I guess the idea that it felt like leaving was some sort of failure.
Hmm. Like almost like I'm letting them win.
Yeah.
Kinda. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I felt, yeah, actually like, you know, like aggressively competitive for certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, some leaving felt like, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm like younger than you.
Right, right, right.
And I don't want to say I'm better than you, but like I have years advantage, right? In the sense of like, I can stick this out for longer than you can.
Sure.
So can I stick it out?
Yeah. And you definitely got that chip on your shoulder at that point too.
And like at that point, as I grew more confident in myself and as I understood the business more.
Sure.
Because that was like the first lesson too, is to realize that coming out of college with all this like sort of textbook knowledge, it's okay, but at the end of the day, it doesn't mean a lot. You know, you've got to understand your business, how your business flows, what your industry is, how your industry works. You got to understand the ins and the outs of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think college was necessary for you?
Yes, but not because of like the academics specifically.
Okay. Just kind of a chance to go out, become a man on your own type of a thing.
I think 100%. Like for me, like I said, born and raised in Los Angeles, really small private school. You know, obviously I had a lot of people coming into my life, but in terms of like my best friends, my core group and stuff like that, kind of solidified at like second grade.
Hmm.
Then I go all the way through 12th grade with the same group of people at a really small school. And then, I went to college at University of Miami, and at the time, nobody from LA was going to Miami.
Right.
It was all like New York and kind of East Coast kids, stuff like that. And so I went there. I did not know a single person in Florida, let alone, you know, like the University of Miami. That in and of itself, like if I just stopped there, was like so important to like my growth as a person and, you know, like my ability to to feel confident that like I could do it, you know, and to be adaptable and to like go out there and just like make completely new friends and like find a new group of people and like thrive, you know? And the truth is like I did, I thrived, you know? And so that part, and then it's not discounting any of the other stuff that I learned. I mean, like, look, at the end of the day, I majored in business management. I had a minor in marketing and that stuff. But like, man, 20 some odd years later, like, do I recall my education for like when I'm in a marketing meeting and being like, well, actually, excuse me, I minored in marketing.
Professor,
and, you know, and so no, you know, now for me, it's like my knowledge or just like, where are we at in the world now? Because I can tell you, if I went back to school right now, whatever they're teaching in those marketing classes is not what I learned.
Right. Well, and it changes so fast.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, you know, again, like I was on a flip phone in college.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, my sister went to My stepsister went to University of Miami, I think like 4 years after me, something like that, maybe five. Mm. And when she was going into school, because I was completely out already. So it was like 5 or 6 years after me. And when she was going to school, I remember that summer, I was like, do you know anyone going? Because really, when I went to Miami, nobody from LA went to Miami. Mm-hmm. Nobody. Not even for vacation. Miami was not what Miami is today.
Sure.
What I realized when I got there was Miami was becoming what Miami is today. And that's why it was so amazing for me, because I called some people that I knew from LA that were a year below me. And I was literally like, don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
But this fucking place is crazy.
Yeah.
And like, don't even look at another school. Like, this is the fucking school. Like,
yeah.
I go to the University of Miami, dude. I'm like, this place is, you have no idea what's happening in Miami right now. Funny enough, literally 3 out of 4 of them came to Miami.
Oh, really?
And then Miami started to become a really big school, not in size, but from like the West Coast, and it started to get a name. And obviously the football program helped back in those days. But whatever, what I was trying to say was my sister went like 6 years later and I asked her if she knew anybody going, and she's like, no, but I'm on this website that connects people that are like going to the same schools. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I'm like, what is it? And she's like, it's called Facebook. Mm. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, yeah, we didn't have that. Like, we had an email system that, you know, people could email you and be like, hey, I'm going to be like in your dorm or something like that.
Right.
And she was literally like, I'm on this website that connects people going to schools. And like,
it's like so 2006.
I mean, yeah. So I'm out of school at this point where like Facebook, we didn't have any of this stuff, you know? Right. So, you know, today I can't imagine what's going on in that marketing.
No kidding, dude.
You know, class. I mean, I see people on Instagram that have 10 million followers that are students at the University of Miami.
Yeah, that's the thing. It almost doesn't even make any sense to teach anything practical or tactical in college anymore. In those domains, in that world where it's just like, but an app update renders this entire textbook useless.
Yeah.
You know, so like, what are we really teaching and learning here? You know, like maybe principles of marketing, like psychology of how humans make decisions and things like that. That's tried and tested. And that was true in the 70s and the 20s, and it's true today, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the, you know, go here.
Yeah, there are steadfast sort of like things about how people make decisions or like, I don't know, what colors catch people's eyes or like whatever it may be. But like, yeah, I mean, I can't remember the last time I like recalled a lesson I learned.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I was just curious. Are you gonna push your kids to go?
To Miami?
Not to Miami, to college. Just to college, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, you know, I got one in kindergarten and one in preschool.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, they're 10, 12, 13 years away from even like coming up to that decision. Like I gotta see where it is and where it's headed. I mean, part of me feels like the experience of it to me was so important. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're ready for at 18 unless you are really singularly focused on something and you have this like crazy passion.
Yeah.
Where if my kid came to me and was like, you know, look, I gotta go do this. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I saw it and I agreed with it, you know, but otherwise I would be like, man, like, I think you got to go try it.
Yeah, test it out.
You know, I don't think I'm going to be one of those dad that's like, you're not dropping out or like anything like that. But like, I think you got to go try it, because like I said, like to me, just the experience of getting on that plane, landing in Miami and being like, wow,
I guess I live here now.
I have no safety now.
Right.
Like, I remember those first few days walking around campus being like, I don't have anyone to call right now. Right. I don't have anyone to go to lunch with. Like, I don't have a plan tonight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it was like
wildly different.
Yeah. Like, it was just like this. And, you know, that to get that far outside of my comfort zone was super character building for me. And like, it was a very, very, very important time in my life. And I look back at it now and I think about how well I handled that. It not what I expected.
Hmm.
Not what I expected from myself, to be honest with you. Like,
yeah.
I felt like I had been way too sort of like sheltered and guarded. And so I'm very like, you know, I'm very like proud that I was like, that I did so well, you know, and I think it was important for me. So like, that's what I would want for them more than like, hey, you got to go get a higher education.
So when, to get back into the story here, when you were first really starting to take over in terms of like, all right, now we, everybody kind of understands like, look, Chad is the leader here. He's the one in charge. What do you do with a company that's been around for that long, that's already doing big numbers? Like, it's seemingly easier to come in and be a visionary of a startup because it's just like, there's a world of endless opportunity and you have a small lean team and you can pivot in any direction you want to go in. But when you're stepping into an organization that's been around that long, that does that much revenue already, that has that many partners, that many employees, that many moving parts, what do you do when you're first coming in? Are you like trying to optimize for something? Are you setting goal? Like what's the, you know, first 30, 60, 90 when you're in charge?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, so I look at my company and I kind of mentioned it earlier that I kind of split my company down in twos.
Okay.
One side of my company is sort of like the creative and the development side of my company. And then the other side of my company is the operational side of my company.
Okay.
So fortunately for me, I felt like there was tons of room for improvement on both sides.
Okay.
Like, company's a great company. It's been successful, but you know, we're in an interesting industry and, you know, you can't kind of like at that particular time when I was coming around, you definitely could not like rest on your laurels.
Hmm.
I also feel like within one generation, there's only kind of like so much that you can do, you know, before it feels like things maybe start to get like stale.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and this is no, like really no, like not trying to be like disrespectful to anybody, but I definitely feel like at the time where I saw the most opportunity was, I really felt like Doc Johnson had become stale on the creative and the development side, which is kind of really like more my passion than even the operational side. And on the operational side, I felt like we were super antiquated. Okay. So kind of to answer your question, for me at the time, it felt like there was a lot to do, but it was just in these two completely different worlds.
Sure.
On one hand, I'm looking at like our machinery and how to be more efficient. And how to like, even just like the minutia, like we didn't have like time studies for like our products to like understand how to like accurately like price a product based on material, how long it took to make it.
Interesting.
Like you got to remember, like we're making like at our and at our time when every single thing, I mean, we're still own the factory in Mexico, so we still manufacture ourselves. It's still all our operation, but like we're making 15 to 20,000 pieces a day.
Jeez.
In our facility, and all those products are different. Our machines and our production lines are set up on like material, not by like mold. So like for instance, we run a realistic skin tone color, let's call it like vanilla, right? And we'll catch that material in 100 different molds. Making an 8-inch dildo is very different than making a 13-inch dildo or a masturbator. Might be the same exact material, but the time that it takes to fill the mold, the time that it takes for that mold to cure, the time that it takes to extract that product, the time that it takes to take that product into finishing and packaging, now that's when you start to have all these variables, right? A lot of Doc Johnson stuff, because we were so successful so quickly and you know, it's like a good problem to have, but it's a problem. It's like, we just like, we're using this, like, you know, this like overall pricing structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And so
it's like arbitrary.
Yeah. But as the industry started to become a lot more competitive, and that's what was happening when I came in. I mean, there were new sex toy companies coming into the industry all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, our market today is super saturated. So you know, for me, on one hand, it was like, okay, operations, really important because we're a manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the lifeblood of our business. We could be the most creative company in the world. If our operations are shit, we're going out of business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So, and then on the creative side, you know, for me, it was like, obviously, as a younger person, seeing that sex toys needed to be marketed, you know, that there was a market out there that was missing, you know, female couples, more modern, more like hip, I guess, younger, skewing, mm-hmm, like kind of the legacy products were the legacy products, but like, what are the new products?
Yeah.
So that was like another part of it for me where it was like, you know, we've got to kind of look at like our product selection,
yeah,
and like who we're marketing towards and like what kind of company we are. Because the hard thing about Doc Johnson is we don't come to work and do the same thing every day. Like, our company is not female focused, 18 to 35. That's who we make product for, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of companies in my business. They have 10 items. They're all vibrators. They do the same thing every day. They know exactly who their market is. I have 1,500 items.
Jesus.
All of my products are made for straight, gay, lesbian, you name it, male, female, anything in between, trans, 18 to 88. So as a overall, that's a really hard company to market because you don't have like tunnel vision.
Right.
You know,
it's way more expensive to market that broad.
For sure. You know, and so one of the things that I tried to do, and I think, I don't want to say it'll be sort of like my legacy on the company, but I hope that it's part of it is like, I made the decision because it's, maybe it was easier for me to do it, but I made the decision that Doc Johnson wasn't sort of a brand. It was like the brand. And then we would have sub brands under that, that those brands were cohesive, curated brands of product that spoke to one specific market.
Gotcha.
So that the marketing strategies and the plan and the packaging, the colors that are used, the language that is used, were tailor-made to what that brand was about.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible to make Doc Johnson curated.
Yeah.
It's just impossible. So Doc Johnson, our marketing kind of concept with Doc Johnson is like, we're a sex toy business. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just like, we want to make you feel good. You know, we're like the Procter and Gamble of like sex toys.
Yeah.
And it's important that the Doc Johnson part is out there. But in terms of like B2B and now our opportunities on B2C is like, you know, what are our sub brands? And like, that's really where we've seen a ton of success in the last 10-ish years.
Interesting. Okay.
Has been becoming like a house of brands.
So basically Doc Johnson owns a bunch of different brands that this one markets to 25.
Doc Johnson owns Ritual. Doc Johnson owns Goodhead. Doc Johnson owns Optimal. Doc Johnson owns, you know, I can go on and on and on and on, and I can name all these brands, and I could sit there and tell you exact, I could show you like what, who they're for, what their marketing deck is, you know, why I would.
So at what part of the process does that start becoming operationally complex? Because like everything else is the same, I'm assuming, right up maybe until you get to packaging. And then you have to put different color schemes and different logos and names and brands and whatever. It's,
in the beginning phases too, I mean, what products are in this line? Who's this line for? Why are we making this line?
Yeah.
You know, or do we have a really successful line that we want to expand? A lot of times it's just expansion too. Yeah. You know, we saw lines that we kind of had that just weren't grouped together. And it's like, oh, you know what? These products all kind of work together.
Sure.
You know, filling gaps in the market, you know, also finding things that people are coming to us and being like, yo, this is doing really well right now. Like, we want to have like an option from Doc Johnson.
Is that a lot of your R&D is just like listening to what people are telling you they're wanting? Like, how are you, like, how do you?
It's an important part. I don't know if it's a big part, but it's an important part. I mean, look, we have, you know, 48 years in the business. We have amazing relationships. And, you know, I think we have the best salespeople in the industry. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, listen, there's a lot of people that work with us that are buyers of our product that they're like, they'll tell us like, hey, this is something that's happening right now. You know, we want to buy this from Doc Johnson if we can.
Yeah.
Or like, hey, this product's great. We think it would look really good in like your, couldn't this be like in your ritual line? And we're like, oh gotcha. Yeah, maybe it could be like 100%, you know, and then we'll sit down and we'll look at it. Or we'll sit down and we'll look at like what the product is or like what the category is. And we'll say like, do we have anything that this fits or is it worth us actually developing like a new brand for? And then if it's developing a new brand, it's like, okay, what's that brand? Let's start. Like, what's the ethos? How many products are going to be in it? Mm-hmm. You know, who are we targeting it for?
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So sometimes it can happen later on. And then a lot of times though, it's kind of like right at the beginning.
Was there ever like products that you made where you're like, I don't know who's going to buy this or like, or you're just shocked that it keeps selling?
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of legacy items that are, you know, that I'm shocked sell.
What are a couple that you're just like, oh my God, dude, this is crazy. Buy this.
I mean, I don't know. The one that comes to mind just because it's so random is like, we sell a thing called Golden Girl Anal Jelly. And it's like in a tub. It's like the weirdest label. We're all afraid to change the label because we're like, if we change the label, like we're going to tank the product, you know? And there are things like that where we're like, you know, like we'll try to update it and we'll fucking kill it. And then, you know, and then that's when my dad will come in and he'll be like, I told you, don't change the packaging on this. It sells for a reason.
That was kind of what I was getting at is like, for a lot of businesses, you're kind of making decisions because you're solving a problem that you've experienced or you're part of the market segment that you're kind of marketing to. So you can kind of look at it and be like, oh, that packaging is weird or that branding looks odd because like I'm in that target market. I wouldn't buy that or whatever. But like in this case, if you're selling to that many people and then even if you're selling to the same demographic in terms of like, you know, they're a dude and they're 34 and they're whatever, like, sex is one of those things where it's like people just have different tastes, different kinks, different.
We call it
desires.
Like a sexual fingerprint.
Yeah,
it's like everyone's fingerprint's a little different. It's like the same thing with sex, really. You know, like there's underlying similarities, but yeah. Listen, for Doc Johnson, probably one of the hardest things about my job is like I have to take myself out of my shoes for what I like for certain things.
Yeah.
And it might not be because I am the target market, but I'm not the target market. It's like, you know, even if it's a male product, I might just be like, okay, this is not what I would go buy, but I do think that this is more like mass marketable. And so there are times where I'll kind of have to take, you know, that's why I have a team, you know, I have a full art department and marketing team and creative team and, you know, we take a lot of opinions and I'm not, you know, I mean, I have the power to veto or overrule or whatever, but I don't, it's not something I really do because I'm like, I don't know if this is my product, you know, or if this is like my package, but like, I get why it makes sense, you know? Also just like one of the things that also like I find interesting too for us is like, you know, some of the sizing of our product, like, you know, some of our stuff is big, you know, and I'm just like, it sells so well.
That's,
you know, and like, I think coming from my company and again, being in every category and for everyone, sort of the all encompassing thing that we always talk about at Doc Johnson is just, it's like, there's just like no shame around anything. It's like there, and I know that there's something for everyone because I see the products that we sell.
Sure.
Yeah. Like I see how many fucking huge dildos I sell.
Yeah.
You know?
Define huge.
Oh man, I mean the size of my forearm, you know, with my fist on the end of it.
2-foot dildos.
Yeah, you know? Jesus. And it's like, I'm like, I see the numbers behind it. And I'm like, okay, like people want this.
Yeah.
You know? And it's making them feel good.
Apparently.
And it's like, you know, it's doing whatever it needs to be doing for them. And it's like, I also feel like in that sense, that's where Doc Johnson comes in and like provides a service that not a lot of other people are willing to provide. Because like all these new, all these new companies that come into my business, you know, into our industry all the time, like they're not coming in like that. They're coming in with like this like really modern, beautiful vibe.
Yeah. Look how elegant.
And, you know, and like whatever, which is like, great, I guess, like no problem, more power to you. Like, but I know this other side of the business that's like, I'm just like, this is also a really big part of the business. And it's like, there's a lot of people out there that want these products.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's stuff like that where I'm just like, okay, I don't know what I would do with that, you know?
Yeah.
Or like, but whenever someone asks me for like a box or like a gift box or like whatever, like I always include like a gigantic dildo.
We should have got one of those for this interview.
It's just like, unboxing.
In
my own mind, what's funny about it is I feel that they feel responsible for it now. Like they're not going to throw it away because it's almost like disrespectful. Yeah. So now they have to hold on to this gigantic dildo in their house or in their closet. And it's just going to be there for, and I, in my mind, it's there forever.
Just one day the movers are just.
And it's got to move and it's got to go to different apartments. It's got to go to different houses. And like, there's like this weird connection to it, even though I know it's never, ever getting used.
Totally. Yeah. It's got to be like, no pun intended here, a gag gift.
Yes. No. There's a certain part of our business that I do think is like bachelorette. And
yeah, with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I have to imagine anyway. Yeah.
There's a lot of people using it too.
Yeah. But also,
The numbers go above and beyond the bachelorette world and they go above and beyond the gag world.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Is my opinion.
Sure.
But I agree that there is a massive, powerful, unit out there with like the bachelorette parties and the bachelor parties and stuff like that, where people are like, let's get a fucking gigantic dildo, you know?
Do you find it difficult to hire into the company? Is there any layer of additional difficulty for you guys? Like when you're like, oh, we're hiring designers or whatever. And a designer like hops on and they're all excited and they're like, oh wait.
Definitely.
I'm designing what?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, got to have someone that's want to do this, you know? And I think that also.
Like, are you just posting on Indeed or whatever?
No, we are. Yeah, for sure. I mean, but we've lost a lot of people who like, don't want to do it. Don't know the business. Don't want to get into the business or have second thoughts. We've had people come in for interviews and then we've really liked them and then been like, we want to offer you the job. And they're like, you know what? On second thought. Mm. I think it's for a couple of reasons. It's like, whether they're right or wrong about this, I think the feeling is that this is sort of like a missing time on your resume.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people that are like designers or like whatever, they're trying to kind of move around, move up and kind of continue to, they don't want to do like these lateral movements. They want to do these vertical movements. And like, I think depending on the X number of like months or years that you spend at an adult company, I think maybe they might view it as this missing part of your resume. It's like, oh, well, where were you from 2020 to 2024? And it's like, oh, I made like sex toys. And it's like, oh, and now you want to come to my consumer beverage, So I do think that there's this like feeling that there's like a missing part of your resume if you kind of come to adult. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think that's the feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to get past that. I mean, you got to get past that idea for certain people, but I'll tell you that a lot of people come into our business, they don't leave. Hmm. I mean, the industry, not Doc Johnson.
Sure.
Like a lot of people that come into adult, man, they love it. Like they don't leave.
Well, dude, this has been a fascinating conversation. Before we take off, where's the best place for people to go connect with you or your company or, where do you want people to go?
I'm glad you asked, Travis. I'm like the worst person to ask that question to, by the way. I swear. You can get everything that you need to know, through our link tree at Doc Johnson USA, which is our Instagram handle. Of course, shopdocjohnson.com. All of our product is for sale on there. Right. And then one of our sub brands that's a big site as well as My Main Squeeze.
Okay.
And that's one of the mymainsqueeze.com. That's, one of the brands that we have where we partner with performers. The industry, because that's a big part of Doc Johnson. It's actually something that we invented is molding performers like genitalia for use in the privacy of your own home.
So
go to Doc Johnson USA on Instagram and everything is there
at Doc Johnson. I know Johnson
we have
USA.
A link tree.
Yeah.
Doc Johnson USA.
You can find whatever you want to find from that.
And it's a pretty good Instagram. Yeah. My friends send it to me all the time and they're like, yo, your Instagram is actually hilarious. Because all we do
you
is
gotta
like,
be right.
You all gotta we do be. Is like sex, funny memes, and, yeah. and things like that. Because nobody wants to see you put your product up on Instagram and be like, "Oh, look at this new." So we're literally a meme page.
Yeah.
But like the people that run gotta it, be. Like you know, are people who do that for us. Our social be like, it's funny. Like yeah. I have friends send it to me all the time, and they're like, "Dude, Dr. Johnson's a hilarious page to follow."
Sick.
Like not knowing, like knowing it's mine, sure. but they're like, they know it's not me.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
At so, Doc Johnson USA over on Instagram. Yep. Go over there, follow, hit the link, and you know, who knows what rabbit hole you're going to be down for the next couple of hours. Chad, thanks so much for coming to the show.
Dude, awesome. I appreciate it. Thank you, man. It's a cool conversation.
Yes, sir. That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet. Then leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.